From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. People grumble plenty about government, and often with good reason, but would government be better if it were run more like a business, or at least in a business-like manner? California's budget could probably use some reform, and a couple of bills in the legislature would make big changes. One would require multiple-year budgets, the other performance-based budgets. Both bills are getting bipartisan support. Well, how would these bills improve the way California raises and spends money? And what does an actual business person think about these proposed changes? We'll start our discussion with a Democratic state senator, Marc Desaulniers, who's author of a bill that would change one of these bills that we're talking about. It's called SB 15. It would require multiple year budgets. He's on the phone. Senator Marc Desaulniers, thanks for joining us today on Insight.
My pleasure to be with you.
Well, what is a multiple year budget?
Well, it's just actually giving the legislature and the public and the administration, for that matter, more analytical tools in a very complex budget and a very complex economy so that we can make better informed decisions.
The legislature, I guess, right now comes up with the governor comes up with a budget and along with the legislature that projects spending over the coming fiscal year. What would be different with a multiple year budget?
Well, in this particular proposal, we would do two-year budgets. We would actually do one and then a revolving one. So every year we would do the anticipated revenue and expenses and then do the next year as well. And then within this proposal is also a five-year expenditure plan, which, again, will give us more of an ability to anticipate the changes. None of this is an exact science, but in a term-limited world, I would argue that the more analysis we have, the less ideologically our decisions will be based.
Why would having these two-year and five-year projections, I guess, why would they help come up with the budget for the fiscal year at hand?
Well, again, more information is a good thing. More transparency, the public will be able to follow it. Having been a business owner for 35 years, these are the kind of things you look out for, is to try to make sure that you can balance your books and that you invest properly and you don't overexpend, which is one of the big problems we have here in California. So we spend more than we take in.
My guest is Marc Desaulniers, Democratic state senator, author of a bill that would require multiple-year budgets in the state of California. You said that that if your bill became law, it would require basically a two-year and a five-year
projections.
Budget. Yeah, projections. Why 2 years and why 5 years?
We're trying to do this in a way that, again, gives us more analysis, but also that's realistic. So we've certainly seen that economists are not perfect in their projections in the last 5 years, whether it's the global economy or just here at home trying to do our own budget. So we're doing it in a realistic way where the numbers are meaningful but extended out long enough that helps us anticipate the consequences of our decisions.
Well, given the fact that sometimes state revenues and expenditures, I guess, change a lot just in the fiscal year at hand, how can you have much confidence in something that's projecting 5 years into the future when you don't even know who the governor will be?
Well, it's better to at least have the lights on and be able to have some idea what the room looks like than have the lights off. The way we do things now, we're completely, largely in the dark, other than what the decisions we make in that month or that 6 months or that year. So this is not a perfect answer, won't solve all our problems, but will provide us with, I think, a much more thoughtful environment to make fiscal decisions.
Now, you mentioned your background as a small business owner. You've been a small business owner for most of your adult life. Is this the kind of budgeting that you have done as a business owner?
Well, I've owned restaurants for 35 years, and if you don't look at what you did last year and project what you're going to do next year, you can't anticipate simple little things like purchasing, capital improvements, and your payroll. It's a lot different running a $1 million or $2 million business than it is running the state of California. However, some things are similar, and the more information you have and the more you anticipate changes, the better off you are, whether it's in the private sector or in the public sector.
Can you tell us why the state of California does not do multiple year budgets if it's so common elsewhere?
It's just our tradition. There are a lot of things that need to be done, including SB 15, which you're going to talk about in a moment, and performance-based budgeting. But the most important thing, I think, and particularly in a term-limited world, the more information we have in the legislature, the better off we are and the better the public is. It's just about more information.
Yes. And what has the governor's office said to you about this proposal? And what are lawmakers on both sides of the aisle saying to you?
Well, we've had bipartisan support, as you said, as we've gone through the process. We did last year as well in the Senate, and then it stalled in the Assembly. We've had multiple conversations with the administration, with the finance director, and we've changed the bill quite a bit to accommodate their concerns as to whether they can actually accomplish what we're asking them to do. So we're feeling very good about it. We got it out of the Senate unanimously just recently, and the communication we've had with the governor's office has been good. In addition, the governor ran, when he ran for election, he mentioned often that he believed in multi-year budgeting and more forecasting.
Okay. Marc Desaulniers, Democratic state senator, author of a bill, SB 15, that would require multiple-year budgets for the state of California. Senator, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, the other lawmaker who we plan to talk with this morning is Susan Bonilla, a Democratic Assemblywoman, sponsor of a bill, SB 14, that would require performance-based budgets in the state of California. She's actually on the floor right now, and she hopes to call us in a few minutes' time when she's done. In the meantime, we're going to talk for another perspective on all this with Carl Guardino, who's the CEO of Silicon Valley Leadership Group, which is a trade association representing some 350 Silicon Valley companies. Carl Guardino, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be on the program, Jeffrey.
Well, let's start with multiple-year budgets. What do you think about that proposal for the state of California?
Well, first, kudos to Senator Desaulniers for his leadership on this issue. This is something that we don't only do as businesses and that many government jurisdictions do around the nation, but we do it as families as well. You do a budget, you know where you're going to spend your money, and you forecast as far out as you can. And the reason the two-year budget is good is it allows that forecast. And Jeffrey, you asked an excellent question about, do you really have any visibility budget-wise in a five-year time horizon? Well, it may be pretty dim 5 years out, but again, that's why you annually update it so that you have trends that you develop over time so that you get a better sense of how those horizons are working too. And it gives you as much room to see that train going down the track with the light shining the way as possible.
You said that not just businesses and households, but many governments do this as well. Have you any take on why the state of California hasn't been doing it?
I think a lot of it's inertia. We've done it this way. We've always done it this way. We're not going to change doing it this way,
but
whether
some...
it works or not. And that's why we need leaders like Marc Desaulniers and Lois Wolk and Susan Bonilla and others who have stepped up in a very bipartisan way, with Senator Huff leading the effort on the Republican side, to say, you know what, it's hard to turn a yacht's direction, but we're going to do it in California, because in front of this yacht continues to be icebergs that we're hitting. The ship is taking on water, if not sinking, and it's time to turn.
Do you think anyone or any organization gets something for its benefit out of doing just single-year budgets?
Good question, and I can't think of anyone who benefits from a state not looking as far out in their time horizon as possible and not planning for the future. That doesn't serve any interest very well. And again, I think we've done it this way for so long that you just don't even think about changing course. Well, now we have legislators who know year after year after year of budget deficits and delays and partisanship, we've got to look for better models. It's why the work that we're doing at California Forward, on whose board I serve, is important, because it's looking at the best practices of 49 other states and what might be incorporated here in California. And one of those key best practices that we think is applicable to the Golden State is multi-year budgeting that has served so many other states, Texas and others, so well.
Some of the leaders in this, in these efforts to change the way California writes and manages its budget, are Democrats. You're the CEO of a business group. What are your relations usually like with Democrats in the state legislature?
And you're right. The Silicon Valley Leadership Group is owned and driven by 345 Silicon Valley CEOs, all size companies, overwhelmingly high tech, biotech, and clean and green tech as the driving industries of the innovation economy. But we are nonpartisan. And David Packard, co-founder of Hewlett Packard, created the organization 33 years ago to not endorse candidates, not give political contributions to candidates, but strictly to operate in what's going to help California and our nation succeed. succeed. And so we look at this not from an ideological standpoint, but from a business standpoint of how can government best serve the people that it is set out to serve, and that is by having good information as early as possible to make the best non-ideological decisions that are going to benefit Californians as possible. We see a multi-year budget as a perfect fit for that type of thinking.
We hope to talk with Assemblywoman Bonilla about the performance-based budget bill that she's a sponsor of. She's not able to join us at this point. We hope to talk with her, but just in case we don't manage to, could you just tell us what performance-based budgeting is?
Absolutely. Senate Bill 14, which is a bill co-authored by Senator DeSaulnier, your earlier guest, but also his Democrat colleague, Senator Wolk, and his Republican colleague, Senator Bob Huff, came together for performance-based budgeting. This one is so obvious that it's one of those where you hit your forehead and wonder why we haven't been doing it always. But it increases the focus on results, and it strengthens transparency and accountability. At its core, at least once every 10 years, and we think it should be more often, but at least once every 10 years, every state program would be reviewed so that we can identify, is it working? If it's working, should we continue to fund it? Should we fund it more? If it's not working, what can we do to improve it? How can we increase its efficiency? Or should we shift those limited resources to more effective programs? So it's that basic oversight function that our legislature should have more in terms of auditing and overseeing existing programs and making sure we do it at least every 10 years for every single state program.
Well, this bill would formally require the state to do that, but as you said, it's kind of a forehead slapper. Isn't the state at least informally doing that anyway, trying to determine whether its programs work and deserve to be funded?
They can. The issue is, in the rough and tumble, busy, everyday life of legislators, does it happen, and does it happen systematically with every single program? We as taxpayers pay for these programs. We need to know, are they working? And if they are working, great. If they'd be working even better with more funds, then we should know that. If they're not working, how can we fix it? Or how do we shift those funds to other priority needs that our state has? Again, this is one that other governments do, certainly successful businesses do, and that we do in our own households.
Okay. And finally, Carl Guardino, is there another big reform that you would like to see made in the way California runs its budget?
In terms of the budget process, both for multi-year budgets and performance-based budgeting, that's why the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, of which I'm CEO, as well as California Forward, on whose board I serve, are championing these two proposals. Are there other things that we can do to strengthen our budget process? Certainly there are, but right now we're focused laser-like on making sure these two get through the legislature before they go out of session at the end of this week, and that the governor smiles upon them with his signature within the next 30 days.
Okay. Carl Guardino, CEO of Silicon Valley Leadership Group, thanks for joining us.
It's been an honor, Jeffrey. Thank you.
And Assemblywoman Susan Bonilla joins us now. She's on the phone. Assemblywoman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, I know you're busy right now. You were just on the floor, but you managed to step off for a few minutes?
Yes.
What was it that appealed to you about performance-based budgeting?
Well, I think it was really that I saw it work at the local level when I was the mayor of the city of Concord. So I really believe that it improves the organization and that the employees within the organization also really benefit when you allow effectiveness and efficiencies to really penetrate to all levels of the workplace.
This is a time of year, an important time of year, because the fate of a lot of bills is determined. And so a lot of lobbyists and special interests are hanging around the Capitol, making their case, talking to lawmakers. Mm-hmm. Are there any particular groups who are concerned about the performance-based budgeting bill or the multi-year budgeting bill?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it has overwhelming support. I think everyone realizes that we need to really make a very clear commitment to making government work better, so that the governance of the state can actually be seeing it marked improvement.
Yeah. Earlier, we talked with Senator Marc Desaulniers, who's author of a related bill, SB 15, on the multi-year budgets. I noted that both of you are former members of the Concord City Council and the Contra Costa Board of Supervisors. Is that just a coincidence, or is there some experience you both had there that informed your position on all this?
I would say it was certainly probably our experience in the city of Concord, where while on the city council, we began doing 10-year projections for the budget. You can't nail down the numbers very specifically, but it certainly gives you an idea of where you're going and if you're heading into trouble. So it's a very valuable tool to give the multi-year look at the budget issues.
Assemblywoman Susan Bonilla, she's a Democrat and sponsor of a bill, SB 14, that would require performance-based budgets in California. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Marcus Bertone's take on some of the top stories in news and sports. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Time for Insight Online with Insight's Jen Picard. Jen, hi.
Hi, good morning. So we just heard about two bills that are moving through the California Assembly. They would reform the budget process. We'd like to know what you think about these bills and what you would do to make the budget process in California smoother and more timely. And there's still time to tell us what your favorite comic is and why. Pearls Before Swine creator Stefan Pastis will talk about his work a little later in today's show. You can comment on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio, or send us an email to insight@capradio.org. Yesterday, we talked with two experts about tips for writing a better resume. They had some great ideas and suggestions for standing out in the super competitive job market, and it prompted an email from Sacramento Public Library Director Rivka Sass. She writes, "Anyone with a library card can get resume help for free by using our Job Now service. It includes available jobs, and users can upload their resumes and receive suggestions for improving them. You can find a link to that information, as well as examples of well-written resumes and ideas for interviewing at our website, www.capradio.org/insight.
Well, thank you, Jen.
You are quite welcome.
Well, time now for our regular talk with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. The first Wednesday of each month, we discuss some of the top stories in news and sports. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
You know, earlier we were talking about these budget bills, and one person described them as forehead slappers because it's the kind of thing where you go, well, how come California doesn't already do this? It's not just businesses, but it's households and even other governments. And there doesn't seem to be any opposition to them that I'm aware of. And to me, that just speaks to the state of our government, that things that seem to be obvious elsewhere are just not the norm.
Yeah, and it's been that way for so long that we don't know any different at this point. And I have to tell you, I did listen to the segment, and you try to be hopeful. You try not to get downcast about things. But we've been in this cycle now for so long of negativity and futility that it's a challenge to remain objective and hopeful about fixing some of the structural issues at the state capitol, since it's hard to remember a time when it wasn't dysfunctional. At least we didn't have the state budget go into Labor Day as we did in years past, but we still have a long way to go.
Well, we do, and not just statewide, but also in the city of Sacramento. Our guest tomorrow, one of our guests is going to be the new city manager, John Sheary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you got to wonder what possessed him to take the job, because there are a lot of municipal headaches in the city of Sacramento, too.
Well, he came from Cincinnati. I have met Mr. Sheary. He came from Cincinnati. He's the first professional city manager that Sacramento will have had in quite a while. The gentleman who occupied the post the last several times have really had different skill sets and were elevated to the job maybe before they were ready, maybe when they shouldn't have been. He was in a city that actually, if you can believe it, was a little more dysfunctional than Sacramento. Cincinnati, actually, the city council people are partisan there. There are Democrats and Republicans on the council, unlike here. And he was able to last 8 years, 8 very tumultuous years there, you know, has a city manager ever lasted that long in Sacramento? Maybe not since they had, you know, covered wagons here in town. So so it's going to be interesting. But he did sign a contract, and in the contract it stipulates that if Sacramento changes its form of government, if it goes to a strong mayor form of government, he can opt out and walk away with some money.
6 months of pay, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, when I asked about why would the city enter into an agreement like this, the response that I got off the record, of course, was that, well, why would anyone want to work here unless you had some kind of a guarantee? Why would anyone want to work with these council people unless you had some sort of financial guarantee that you weren't going to have the rug pulled out from under you? So that's what we've become, and I've said this before on the show, we've become the Oakland Raiders of municipal government, where we have to hire people who probably get asked the question, why'd you take this job in the first place?
My guest is Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. Tomorrow is the big day when the arena financing plan, the hoped-for financing plan, will be unveiled officially at the Sacramento Press Club, but there's been lots of leaking about what's expected to be in it for some time. What do you make of what you've heard so far? Do you think it's going to add up?
Well, you know, I think that it's going to be a mistake to view tomorrow as the end of something when really it's more the beginning of something. I think they're going to lay out, I think they've already tipped their hand on what they're going to do. You know, there's a whole range of potential revenue streams that they could tap into. I can already see that the most controversial in Sacramento will be the potential sale of public lands with the revenue going to the debt service of the arena. That potentially could be very controversial. Also, there will be a battle royal between interests representing Sacramento and the Kings and the NBA. The Sacramento people, I believe, are going to try to use the Anaheim deal as a template. And that deal was not particularly favorable to the NBA if you compare it to other deals around the country where, you know, to use a basketball analogy, the NBA would slam dunk different communities, and those communities would assume the risk and expense of the arenas while the NBA would reap the profits. That's not going to happen here.
But the league must know that everything has changed. The economy has changed.
I'm sure they know, but it doesn't mean they're not going to fight tooth and nail, and it doesn't mean that they're not going to potentially play Sacramento off of another city to try and get the very best deal they can for themselves. And I do think that Anaheim is still in play. I do think they like Anaheim.
The Maloofs.
Well, I think the NBA potentially has identified Anaheim as a future destination for an NBA team. I think that there was some concern about moving them on the eve of a work stoppage, which is now several months in. And I do think that there were some concerns that if the billionaire in Anaheim who was trying to lure the Kings down there, if he's going to buy an NBA team, they'd be fine with that. But they'd like him to pay full market value for a team as opposed to loaning them a whole bunch of money and then possibly foreclosing on that loan and assuming control of the team that way.
And I just read the other day in the Bee, I was reminded of the fact that Anaheim hasn't just put its hands up in there and said, okay, whatever.
Right.
They're doing renovations of their
renovations of
arena.
The arena. They want to be an NBA market, and I think that they could be potentially be a lucrative NBA market. There's still the big fight to deal with in that the Los Angeles teams that are there now are strongly opposed and have a financial stake. So there's an awful lot of money involved. For us in Sacramento, there are going to be several keys. One, not only what they're going to reveal tomorrow, but also there has to be a private operator, an AEG, for example, they run the Staples Center and other big facilities all over the world. Without an AEG or someone like that coming into Sacramento, the deal here doesn't work. Mm. There has to be a big private component. And so all those balls are still up in the air.
Yesterday afternoon, I heard Mayor Johnson talking on the Grant Napier radio show about the arena financing plan.
And at one point, radio show?
Grant Napier.
No, I never heard of him.
Well, at one point, Grant Napier said something I've never heard him say before. He drew attention to the wedding ring of his guest, i.e. Kevin Johnson's wedding ring, because apparently the mayor got married with a lot of secrecy last weekend.
A lot of secrecy, yes.
So had you thought you were going to be going to the wedding in Sacramento?
No, Jeffrey. I had no expectation of going to the wedding.
I was disappointed.
I also didn't ever raise it with the mayor for fear that he would punch me in the larynx or something of that nature. The mayor is a very secretive guy. There are aspects of his upbringing that he will not discuss. He was going to have a big public wedding in Sacramento, and I think that the attention that he was generating from that just completely just rattled him and his spouse Michelle Rhee, and these are very public people who are very prickly, very controlling, and they don't like when people ask them about their business, and so they scuttled those plans. They were going to have a big to-do at Angelo Sakopoulos' house, and they scuttled those plans, and those crazy kids ran off to the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee and got married. God bless them. God bless them.
Well, I can understand perhaps their concern about attention, but still, this is Sacramento, and it's Kevin Johnson and Michelle Rhee. It's not the Kardashians in Malibu with helicopters.
Well, no, but even even Sacramento style attention was too much for them, and I did witness the progression of discomfort and anguish on the mayor's face as the date for his previous marriage was getting closer and the questions were intensifying. It was really bothering him, and so it was no surprise when he pulled the plug. And it's curious that he was sort of revealed on a sports talk radio show. But yes. Okay.
You wrote a very touching column, I thought, the other day about Miguel Tejada, the baseball player who seems to be at the end of his career.
Yes.
Is someone you've known for a long time.
Yes.
You've written a lot about him, including a book. Is this the end of his career, do you think?
I believe it is. He's 37 now. Miguel Tejada, I met him when he was a very young man in the early 90s. I was on assignment with the Bee, and we had an idea to do a story on baseball players, impoverished players from Latin America coming to the United States. And those articles became the basis for a book on that subject, and it was really sort of the first book on defining the experience of players from Latin America and a legacy that goes back to the early 20th century and different countries in the Caribbean. They have their own histories with baseball and interesting histories with the United States. And so Miguel really embodied that experience. He came from abject poverty. He had been homeless for a time as a boy. His father was gone for long stretches. He had very little formal education in his own country, let alone ours. But he had a gift to play baseball. And so myself and Jose Luis Villegas, a photographer at the Bee, we met him when he was very young. And we followed his progression. And that story became our story. It became our book. And from the summer of 1996, when he played just down the road in Modesto, to the very next year when he broke in with the Oakland A's, most valuable player of the All-Star Game, signed a $42 million contract, still owes me $50 for paying his freight for all his luggage when he first came back. And I broke the cardinal rule of becoming a friend with someone you write about. And so with that friendship, it opened a window to what can happen when you're on the receiving end of public scorn. And it can be kind of tough.
Yeah, it can be tough watching a talented but aging athlete.
Yes.
Playing out their career.
Yes, and, it just didn't work out. I was so excited when the Giants signed him. It was just weeks after they won the World Series, and he was really hoping, Miguel was really hoping to be a part of something this year. And just from the very beginning, it was obvious that it wasn't going to happen. And unfortunately, it ended last week when he was released by the team.
Which is weeks before the Giants do not win the World Series.
Well, they haven't given up hope. They shaved a whole game off the Arizona Diamondbacks' lead last night, and people haven't given up. The team hasn't given up. They're probably not going to get there this year, but it certainly, for those of us who follow the team back in the battle days, this year has been pretty good.
Marcus Bertoni's a columnist with the Sacramento Bee. His columns usually appear Wednesdays and Sundays in the Our Region section. He also writes about sports, and he's on Insight the first Wednesday of each month. Marcus, thanks again for joining us. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, two scientists, one from Sacramento, the other from Iraq, who are helping restore marshes almost destroyed by Saddam Hussein. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with answers, Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio Senior Editor in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Friday, day after tomorrow, marks the one-year anniversary of the San Bruno natural gas pipeline explosion. Killed 8 people, virtually destroyed a neighborhood. There are 5 bills working their way through the legislature right now in response to that tragedy. 2 all the way on the way to the governor's office right now. 3 others are still pending in the Senate or the Assembly. And there was a news conference to talk about those today.
I see.
Ben Adler was there. He'll have that story this afternoon. Our environment reporter Joe Rubin is following a story coming out of the UC Davis research organization. This one's saying that warming streams could mark the end of spring-run Chinook salmon in California by the end of this century. Now, that's already a fragile run, certainly compared to what it was even 100 years ago or 50 years ago. So that is significant news because salmon, as you know, are an indicator species for much of the Pacific and much of the western U.S.
And also, I think it'd be fair to say a signature species of California.
Well, indeed, it would. And our multimedia producer, Andrew Nixon, is working on a long-term project on the salmon life cycle that will show up on the web and in other places in the next month or so. It promises to be very interesting. Started out at the Nimbus Dam, and we'll catch them when they come back. And then this afternoon, the Republican candidates for president, the ones who would be candidates, will be debating down in Southern California. This happens on the same day that we get a field poll out saying that Republicans in California are not the Republicans they were when Ronald Reagan was here, certainly not when he was president. They're older, and they're more conservative. Those stories after NPR News this afternoon, beginning at 3:30 on All Things Considered on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Mesopotamian marshes of southern Iraq are in the area sometimes called the cradle of civilization. But those marshes and the people who live there and rely on the marshes are in trouble. The late Saddam Hussein drained the Mesopotamian marshes when he ruled Iraq. He did it to punish the marsh Arabs, the people who lived there and were resisting him. Sacramento State ecologist Michelle Stevens has been helping restore the Mesopotamian marshes for years now. This week, one of her colleagues at a university in Iraq is in town, giving talks and raising money for the work there. Michelle Stevens is back in our studio. Michelle, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
And also Nadia Fozi, Associate Professor of Marine and Environmental Pollution at the University of Basra in Iraq. Nadia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Michelle, first of all, could you just remind us, these marshes, how important are they and what condition are they in now?
The Mesopotamian marshes are very important. You've probably your readers have seen the nature shows on TV, and the marsh Arabs are very dear to many people's hearts. It's the biblical Garden of Eden, the source of the 3 Abrahamic religions. The marshes were twice the size of the Everglades. During Saddam's regime, they were desiccated to 10%, and he really committed genocide against the marsh Arabs. And now they were restored to about 60%, but with upstream water diversions in both Turkey and Iran, it's very, very bad right now. And Nadia's been in the marshes, and she can tell the readers more about that. It's maybe 20 or 30%, so very little is left.
Well, Nadia, since you have up to the minute, so to speak, experience of the marshes, what do they look like today?
Very, very dry and really suffering a lot. Both nature and the people who used to live and some stayed there, but they are in a very difficult situation.
Well, as you might have heard when I was talking about some stories in the news with our senior editor, there's a species of salmon that is really stressed and could become extinct. Are you seeing extinctions in the Mesopotamian marshes?
A very, very distinct biodiversity is reduced so much because biota comes with the water, with the fresh water that used to cover the marshes. Now we have a vast area, very dry. So plants and animals that depends on the reeds and the marshes and the whole environmental cycle there are suffering. We have many, many migrant birds, and some of them are local to the area, almost distinct now.
Well, Saddam Hussein tried to dry out the Mesopotamian marshes to punish the marsh Arabs who lived there. What was his problem with them?
They raised against him, and mostly they were Shiite from the south. And because the environment there was so dense with reed, it was very hard for the army to go and get them. So he dried them to flush them out of the marshes. This is one part, and I think this is a major part, but the nature played as well other part on this situation.
But the name Marsh Arab, is that a positive description? Do the people who live there call themselves Marsh Arabs?
Traditionally, they are called Ma'dan, which is a synonym to the Marsh Arab, which is used in the foreign media more. I think difficult saying the word itself, Ma'dan, translate to Marsh Arabs.
It translates to Marsh Arabs.
Yeah.
How are they doing? I mean, the fact that they're called Marsh Arabs suggests that they're very closely connected to the marshes.
Very close. Actually, you rarely, before the 80s, you rarely see them around the cities, the major cities. They come only to sell their products and they go back to live there. And their living was sustainable through the whole environment. They use whatever surround them, food, fuel, whatever it is from their environment. So you don't see them around the cities as much as now after the drying of the marshes.
My guests are Nadia Fozi, who you're hearing right now, and Michelle Stevens. Michelle is a professor at Sacramento State. Nadia is a professor at the University of Basra in Iraq. And we're talking about the Mesopotamian marshes that were all but dried out by Saddam Hussein to punish the people who lived there. There's an effort, an international effort, to try and restore those marshes, but there are many challenges facing both the marshes and the people who live there. Nadia, are you from Iraq?
I am. I'm raised and born in Iraq, in Basra, actually.
So how far were you from the Mesopotamian marshes?
Very close to the marshes. The western side, which is Al-Hammar, which is the largest marsh area, is just on the northern border of Basra city. So we used, as a children and then even at the university, we used to go out to study and to have trips around the marshes.
Are you one of the Marsh Arabs yourself?
No, I'm not. No.
Did you know Marsh Arabs when you were growing up?
Yes.
Are they different in any way from the other people of Iraq?
No, not really. And some of them come to study in the universities, and some of them are really highly qualified people.
And did Saddam Hussein succeed in killing many of them?
Yeah, many of them. Many of them, and many of the southern Iraqi people suffered through that time of killing and prisoning and disappearing.
When you were younger, and when Saddam Hussein was trying to dry out the marshes and punish the people there, were you and others aware of what was happening at that time?
To a certain extent, yes, because it was off limit to many people. And that's why this is one of the sad stories that we didn't learn more about the environment, because it was really hard to go there unless you have a permit. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to go into the marshes.
Yeah. Michelle, how did you get interested and involved in this? Because it seems like a long way from Sacramento.
And from my Native American heritage. Well, it was destiny, and I worked as the first project manager for Azam Alwash with the Eden Again Project. So I've been working for quite some time. And when I went to Iraq as a keynote speaker at a conference, Nadia was my translator and helped me talk to the news there. So we just got back from a conference of the Society of Ecological Restoration in Mexico, where we did a talk on the marshes and restoration of the marshes.
I guess you invited Nadia to Sacramento this week.
I did, and she and a team of women have been talking to women and children in the marshes, and it's quite interesting and quite sad of the conditions in the marshes right now, with lack of education, poor health care, salty water, poor hygiene, just very bad conditions there.
Nadia, is there a particular issue for the women in that area? Because I know that you've been focusing, at least in part, on the life for Iraqi women in the marshes.
The whole society and the Marsh Arab society is really in a difficult situation because of lack of resources. And the instability of the political situation whole in Iraq, it's impacting the whole community, but even more for the Marsh Arabs.
to the extent that Iraq has a stable government, do you think that government is committed to the future of the Mesopotamian marshes and the Marsh Arabs? Or are the Marsh Arabs caught up in any of these ethnic rivalries?
I would say yes, but I think there is a commitment now and recognition, not only for the community themselves, but the impact of the dryness of the marshes on the whole Iraqi environment. We 2 months ago, we had a conference led by UN and Basra University, brought all parties interested in Iraq departments, different government departments, talking about how coordinate efforts to revitalize at least part. We recognize that we can't bring all the marshes back to where they were, but at least part of that. So there is an effort now starting.
This Friday evening at 6, Nadia will be talking. It's a public event. We'll also be showing a movie on the Marsh Arabs. And this is also a fundraiser for HEMA, which is a nonprofit, I guess, established to help this work. Is that right, Michelle?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Whereabouts does this event happen?
It's at the Kiwanis House here in Sacramento. And HEMA Mesopotamia means protection of the land between two rivers. So we're trying to tell the stories and do what we can to help the people of the marshes and the ecosystem.
Michelle Stevens, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at Sacramento State, and Nadia Fozi, Associate Professor of Marine and Environmental Pollution at the University of Basra in Iraq. We've been talking about the Mesopotamian marshes in southern Iraq and the Marsh Arabs there. Michelle, Nadia, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how and why you might want to consider running barefoot. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison.
Good day, sunshine.
Well, it's a good day, sunshine, but you know, when it gets too sunny in the Sacramento Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley, the air quality can get a bit iffy. And today in the Sacramento Valley, unhealthy, spare the air day in effect, just moderate in the San Joaquin Valley. As for today's highs, 99 expected in Sacramento. Looks like yet another day when we almost, but not quite, make it to the triple digits. 97 in Davis and the foothills, 94 degrees today in Colfax. In Reno, 91 degrees, 58 tonight, and that means beautiful weather for the start of the baseball playoffs, the AAA baseball playoffs. The Reno Aces are playing the Sacramento River Cats at the Aces Ballpark in Reno, and the series will move to Raleigh Field on Friday. In the Tahoe area, 80 degrees today in Truckee. And if we look further south, the Republican candidates are assembling in Simi Valley. It's going to be warm there late this afternoon, expecting a high of 95 degrees. That's pretty warm when you're near the coast, 63 degrees low in Simi Valley. You're listening to Insight. Well, why do some people run barefoot and how do they get started? A longtime barefoot runner who also teaches and writes about it came to town recently to explain. His name is Michael Sandler, author of Barefoot Runner, How to Run Light and Free. We started off, I asked him, why would someone want to run barefoot?
I run barefoot. I had a near-death accident 5 years ago. I have a titanium femur, titanium hip. I've had 10 knee operations. I have no ACL. There's a hole where that used to go. And an inch leg length discrepancy.
What was the accident?
The accident was in 2004, did a 5,000-mile, 40-day solo unsupported bike ride across the country to help people with learning disabilities. 2005, I was sponsored by Rollerblade to do a 4,000-mile, 40-day similar event. It was cut short, though, when a father, a tourist visiting Boulder, Colorado, stepped out onto the bike path in front of my training path while teaching his baby how to walk.
Well, with that kind of operation on your leg, a lot of people would be feeling very, very cautious about doing anything with it. And if they were to go out running, they'd make sure they had extra padded shoes on. But you run barefoot. Does running barefoot help your leg?
Oh yeah, what the studies are finding is the more cushioning, that more padding that you have underfoot, the harder you hit the ground because you can't feel the ground. You have more nerve endings in the bottom of your feet than anywhere else in the human body. That helps us to run light if we can feel the ground. Now, with all this titanium parts and all the surgeries, I can't afford shock. I can't afford to run heavy.
So you're saying that when you really feel the ground, you run more appropriately than if you got the latest shoes with thick rubber on the bottom.
Yeah, I call running barefoot running aware foot.
My guest is Michael Sandler. How do you get started running barefoot? I mean, when we step outdoors with bare feet, it's not long before we find something that hurts.
Yeah, well, I have people start on a nice smooth bike path, a very clean surface, and start with only a couple hundred yards. Basically, the distance you would run across a large parking lot and back is the total distance that you want to start. You want to add 100 yards every other day. And not do it in between so your feet have a chance to rest and recover and grow strong.
How much running did you do before you started running barefoot?
Before I ran barefoot, I ran sporadically because I was called Mr. Plantar Fasciitis or Mr. Flatfoot. I was the guy who wore the hard plastic custom orthotic or insole and my motion control Nikes just to go across the living room floor.
And if you'd been told then that one day you would run many miles with bare feet, what would you have said?
I would have said that they were insane.
Really? Because you just could not have imagined that.
Well, my podiatrist recommended, and I believed, that I shouldn't even get out of bed barefoot. My feet were always in constant pain. Right before the accident that happened in my rollerblades, I had stopped in a mountain creek to soak my feet in the creek because my feet were so hot and inflamed from my plantar fasciitis.
My guest is barefoot runner Michael Sandler. He's author of the book Barefoot Runner. If you want to see Michael in action, there's a great YouTube video about him, and there's a link to that on our website, capradio.org/insight. On that video, it shows you running in all kinds of places that people who don't run barefoot would think, oh my goodness, that's ridiculous. Like you're running across these rocks in what looks like a very hot desert. It looks like the rocks are very sharp and hot.
They are. It was actually But it's actually a lot of fun. Your skin toughens up very quickly. First 2 to 3 weeks, the skin starts to strengthen up. The baby fat that you lost since you were a child starts to come back. So we've got a few million years of evolution on our 4x4-like feet. And after you build into it, after the first few months, you can run on some real amazing surfaces.
Yeah, I guess humans did manage to run successfully without fancy shoes for a long time.
If not, we wouldn't be here today.
Another running situation that I saw in the YouTube video was you running through deep snow. I mean, how do you not get frostbite on your toes?
It's fascinating. Barefoot running is a real paradigm shift. What's bad is good, what's good is bad, all that good stuff. What it means is when you're in a shoe in the wintertime, your footwear is doing the job of supporting your body weight. So your body takes blood flow away from the feet, puts it to other parts of the body. Your feet get cold. It's called blood shunting. When your feet are doing the job of supporting your body weight, your body takes more blood flow and puts it to the feet, and they get beet red and hot. So your feet actually get hot when running in the cold because your feet are doing the work of supporting you. What's really great is that additional blood flow that you get helps with healing injuries that are stuck, like a plantar fasciitis that won't go away, or that weak ankle that so many of us have rolled that we're told can't get strong because we don't get enough blood flow back there.
I'm raising my arm in agreement.
Well, now once we get blood flow back there by going fully barefoot and letting the feet do the job, we get more blood flow there, we get a better chance to stand of healing.
You can run over 20 miles barefoot.
Yeah. In fact, I did yesterday, ran all the hills that I could find in San Francisco. In fact, was chasing down trolleys, having a lot of fun, and then went up to Armstrong Redwood Park, I believe it is, up by Santa Rosa, and had a blast running among the redwoods.
If someone were to see you running, would it be obvious, even without looking at your feet, that you run differently from people who have shoes on?
Much lighter. Much, much lighter.
What does it look like when you're running? What's your technique?
The technique is you're standing taller. You stand almost more like a dancer, more like a string is pulling you to the sky. The arms are pulled back to your side. It looks like you've got little spring-loaded chicken wings. You're landing more on your forefoot. You're using the entire leg as a spring rather than your heel. And there's almost no bounce up and down. So it looks more like you're gliding along because you have a much shorter stride, more like pedaling a bicycle.
If someone were not ready to make the jump, so to speak, to running barefoot, would that still be a better way to run even with shoes?
It's a much better way to run even with shoes. The reason I recommend for everybody to strip off their shoes and spend at least a little time fully barefoot is, why don't we use the natural feedback mechanism of the body to teach us our lightest stride? Because when we talk about this being running barefoot is running aware foot, what that means is the foot and our nerve endings are going to teach us what's the lightest way to run. So do some time fully barefoot in the beginning, then go back into your shoes with that stride.
Chris, right now in Sacramento, it's very hot. It'll be about 95 degrees this afternoon. If someone wanted to go down to the American River Parkway and do it barefoot this afternoon, would you say, yeah, that's okay, go ahead and do it, or say, no, it's too hot?
I'd say it's too hot. I'd say do it early morning or in the evenings. If you your only time to run is midday, then let's start off a real baby step way, which means do about 10 feet on the hot stuff, jump onto the grass for another 10 feet, back and forth for a few times. Call it good for a day. Your feet will adapt to that heat. It feels really good underfoot over time, but we really want to start with small baby steps and never hurt the bottom of the feet.
And is it better to run on asphalt or on dirt or what?
I like starting on cement. Cement is cooler than asphalt, and it is a harder surface than asphalt. The harder the surface, the lighter we are going to run because you feel the ground more. For instance, on grass, and I'm okay with everybody running their first time on grass, you feel like you're a kid again.
Yes.
Like you're a 4 or 5 year old running along going, "Wee!" Usually with somebody behind us going, "Put on your shoes." This is the last time we do that. But after that first time, go out onto the hardest surface you can because you won't be able to cheat. On the grass, you'll be able to heel strike and get away with it. The first time you hit your heel though on down on cement, what do?
It's going to hurt.
And you stop.
Yeah. Michael Sandler is author of the book Barefoot Runner, How to Run Light and Free. I'm sorry, Barefoot Running. It's Barefoot Running is the title of the book, How to Run Light and Free. Michael Sandler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
If you'd hoped to hear Pearls Before Swine cartoonist Stefan Pats passed us this morning, sorry. Apparently there was a scheduling miscommunication, so he won't be joining us today. In any case, that was Insight for today. A good one, I think. It was good to hear Michael Sandler, the Barefoot Runner, again. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Liz Cazares. The assistant producer of Insight is James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. After a long search, Sacramento has hired a city manager. On the next Insight, we'll talk with John Shuri about his past work and expectations for the future. Plus, a Sacramento native is one of 6 Democrats on the Federal Debt Panel Supercommittee. Javier Becerra talks about cutting over $1 trillion from the federal deficit. And more sound advice. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.